Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And greetings to all of our patrons listening and chatting with us live as we record in our exclusive Discord community. Now, the BBC wrote this week, just after we recorded last week's episode, actually, slightly annoyingly, that the House of Lords Gambling Committee says video game loot boxes should be regulated under gambling laws. The Lords said that they should be classified as, quote, games of chance, which would bring them under the Gambling Act of 2005, according to the BBC. And the Lords report says, and this is an important quote, I think, if a product looks like gambling and feels like gambling, it should be regulated as gambling. And the Lords warned that such a change should not wait. Another quote from the report: the government must act immediately to bring loot boxes within the remit of gambling legislation and regulation. That was actually according to a statement that came with the report, now think back. But the bottom line is, you know, this is coming from the House of Lords. So this is the other place, as it's referred to in the House of Commons, and is the more senior of the two houses. So it is quite significant that this is a proposal, although yet has to be obviously ratified and go through the process. However, if it does, it could have a massive impact on how companies make money from free-to-play games in the UK. Think Fortnite or pretty much all other games these days. When you actually look at how the regulation currently works, and obviously we're not going to go into huge detail about the legalities of gambling regulation in Britain, but there are a few things that will basically stand as looking in quite sharp contrast to what you would expect for a game. So as a general rule, the minimum legal age for gambling in the UK in general is 18. That excludes things like lottery, which I think is 16, isn't it? I think you
know, it is, yeah.
Bingo at 16 or the pools?
Good question. Don't know, actually. Probably the pools.
Yeah. Also, you can advertise gambling, but if you want to do so on TV, for instance, for gambling products, which again I think excludes bingo and maybe some sport betting, it has to be done after the 9 p.m. watershed, which would basically mean
it definitely excludes the lottery. You can advertise the lottery before 9.
Yeah. And advertisements, they are not allowed to be targeted or even appear to be targeted towards anyone under the age of 18. And that includes things like the kind of presentation of an ad or the context or the content, you know. So when you look at a lot of the promotions for games, always very happy and lots of little squeaky, colourful characters running around getting lots and lots of money. You know, that is very, very clearly not going to pass if all of this were to turn out the way that at least the proposal suggests it might be. But currently in the UK, games that don't enable you to win anything in money or in money's worth, that falls outside of regulation. But when you look at actually how games are monetized with loot boxes and the kind of things that you get in loot boxes, you could argue that since sometimes you can directly buy some of those products for money and sometimes things can be traded, therefore it has a value and therefore may fall within this rule. So we're going to come to a story about this, a particularly interesting one, I feel, because it's one that I experienced this week that I don't think many people, if anyone, knows about worldwide. So it's a bit of an exclusive retelling of this story. But before we get into this story, Ian, what was your first take on loot boxes? Because I know you're not as much of a gamer as me, and I'm not as much of a gamer as many people, but you do play games, and you do play games that have loot boxes. So what's your first take?
Well, I don't. So, well, that's not quite true, is it? Because Destiny does have loot boxes in a sense that you can buy. It's much more oblique in that game. And I don't play any free to play games really with any regularity. So I do think that my exposure to these things is limited. But I follow these stories very interestingly, partly because I'm kind of have to know the gambling rules, and also because I'm just blown away by the fact that this has been allowed to carry on for so long without any sort of hint of regulation. Other countries have regulated, and I feel like that is absolutely the right thing to do, given that there is very real money on offer here, and this argument that you can't win any money back, it doesn't mean anything to me. It's worse, if anything. I mean, at least with actual gambling, you have a admittedly negligible chance of winning an actual cash prize. With a loot box, all the best possible scenario is that you're winning an in-game item. And in a lot of cases these days, because the uproar from the gaming community is quite big, it is generally a cosmetic item. I mean, not always, but often. Like free to play, people don't like pay to win. So, you know, games, for example, I mean, you maybe could talk about this from the Asphalt perspective, but having a better car might help you win the game in those cases. So, therefore, that's a kind of, I suppose, a trade-off you have to make internally. But they're very common as things that are just cosmetic items. Like, for example, I believe that's the case in Fortnite. The things that you can buy or roll for won't affect your ability to play the game. So, yeah. You know, but whether that doesn't really make any difference. I think my point is really more that it's just, why does it need to be like this? Like, why can't they just, you know, charge you money for the things that you want in the game? And the answer is because adding loot boxes reduces your chance of getting what you want, which increases the chance that you'll buy more tokens. Therefore, it's fundamentally quite a dishonest process, and therefore I dislike it.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is not the first time that we've talked about this, and it's certainly not the first time that the issue has come up in the context of proposed legislation. And in fact, actual legislation has happened. I mean, they banned loot boxes in Belgium, I believe, last year or the year before last. I think the Netherlands has taken a very strict view on it as well. And a lot of that only came about years and years after loot boxes became a thing, because was it Battlefront or Battlefront 2 where EA was charging for yes, characters like Darth Vader, like really desirable characters, or Princess Leia or something, and you could only unlock them through loot boxes, and eventually I think EA suspended them.
Yes, they took a EA has been through phases of this and has taken them out of the game, and then there's been some discussion. There's a very exciting game coming up called Star Wars Squadrons. Have you seen it mentioned or have any interest in it?
I don't have any interest in it, no.
Right. Okay, but you know what it is. Well, because obviously people were talking about that from a, you know, will there be loot boxes, or, you know, will there be, additional things that you have to buy? And I think inevitably there will be, but I think they've learned their lesson in terms of holding back characters for people who pay. I just think that's such a crappy way to treat people, especially when you're charging for a game. And I would rather pay for a game. Destiny is a habit that costs me basically 60 quid a year. So, you know, I'm happy to pay that. What I'm not happy with is, you know, the fact that then you are expected to pay more to make the game better. And I can live without the cosmetic things, but
you know, I'm with you, and I don't mind the cosmetics, and I am going to talk about Asphalt shortly, actually.
Yes.
But I just wanted to mention a few of the comments that have been coming in the Discord while we've been chatting, because, Aaron, I don't know if you mind me quoting this, but I assume you don't since you put it in the Discord. It says, I want to spend about $2,000 on a free-to-play game due to loot boxes. I believe Aaron is in North America, so I assume dollars, Canadian or US. Either way, it's quite a lot of money. And John Evans says the most DLC he spent in a game is in Overwatch, which I believe is another free-to-play, isn't it, Overwatch?
It's not. So you pay it.
You buy it up front.
Yeah.
Okay. That's even more difficult.
Yes, but again, it's not with Overwatch. It is only cosmetic stuff.
Yeah.
So okay. it's you know, you're not affecting the outcome of the game, and there's yeah, you know, I can't see a lot of reasons to do it personally, but then I'm not a big Overwatch player. I've played it occasionally.
And Charlotte says that there is a big difference between loot boxes containing items that are needed to progress in the game and when they're things like character modifications, yeah, like a fancy hat, which is absolutely 100% true. And I think part of the difficulty with this is that it is in this marketplace, particularly on mobile, it is overwhelmingly more difficult to get somebody to pay up front for a game when there are so many other very, very high quality games, objectively speaking, that don't cost anything to download and play and allow you to get quite a bit of fun out of it. But ultimately, down the line, once you're kind of hooked and into it, the payment mechanics come into question. So that's a big
also
difference.
You've got to remember as well that the world's biggest games are all free to play and are all making billions of dollars a year. You know, there are some games that I haven't even heard of. That, like, the number one most popular game in the world is very big in China, obviously, so it has a very large audience. But again, it's a free to play game that it clearly exists entirely based on, you know, funding from either in game items or loot boxes of some kind. So, you know, it seems to be an enormously popular way of funding a game, and it's very, very profitable.
Well, I'm going to go into more detail on this now because I wanted to move into a story that is highly relevant to this that I wasn't expecting to talk about. I was going to talk about this as the next extra message for patrons, but I've decided to talk about it here instead because it's so relevant to this news story. And it is about Asphalt. And to take a little step back here, Asphalt is a game by a company called Gameloft, and it is it's a very high-end arcade racer. So think about something like Forza Horizon, something like that. It's very, very high-end graphics, lots and lots of real-world licensed cars, real licensed music, and lots of stuff to play. But it is entirely free to play. It is monetized entirely through in-app purchases, both in terms of like a monthly season pass subscription, where every day you get a free item or a perk, and you get better ones and more of them if you pay that subscription. You can also buy, very occasionally, you can outright buy cars in the game, usually the better cars, but more typically you buy packs of cards that contain blueprints, and you collect a certain number of blueprints to unlock a car. And in principle, and even without any money being involved, it's not a bad system because it rewards you with blueprints for playing or for winning harder matches, or as you rank up in multiplayer games, you will win better blueprints and get therefore better cars and therefore progress even further. And so you can play these games, certainly this game, without ever spending a penny, and it's in that sense it is quite a fair system. However, the game has a huge number of cars, and in the real world these are supercars. These are your Bugatti Chirons and your Lamborghini XYZ. It's not a car, you know what I mean? The very high-end Aston Martins, Lamborghinis, all this kind of stuff, and special supercars that had limited runs in real life. And for most of those, winning the amount of blueprints you need to unlock those cards, I mean, you could probably play the game 24 hours a day, every day for a year, and probably not unlock them. So you've got to be very, 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 very lucky. Or what you can do is buy the card packs, the loot boxes, as they essentially are. And you can do those in a number of ways. And trust me, there is a reason I'm explaining this in very, very great detail. You can either pay to buy tokens, and you use the tokens to buy packs of cards, or you can just pay to buy bundles of cards in packs. And sometimes you get multiple packs, and sometimes you get tokens, which is the in-game currency as well. So that's a long-winded way of saying there are lots and lots of ways to spend money depending on what's the best value at any given point. But it's also it fluctuates quite a lot, and they have lots and lots of very limited time offers where something's available for just a couple of days or once a week. And there are some cars that only seem to appear for purchase once every year. So when you actually get them, they show up and it's like 1 week only and 90% off, and it looks super, super attractive. And for the most part, that's kind of fine because you can still play a huge amount of the game without paying. But they made a mistake this week, And this is what is making this so relevant. And I've not spoken about this at all yet. And I haven't seen anyone else talk or write about this at all. But Gameloft made a big error. And this week, for about maybe 10 minutes, I think it was on Tuesday, it might have been Wednesday actually, but for about 10 minutes, when they did their daily update of like a refresh of the card packs that were available, it made available a card pack that contained 75,000 in-game tokens for £5. That's £5, $5, €5. It's about the same. Now, that on its own, that number on its own doesn't mean anything to most people. What can you, or what is 75,000 tokens? What does that actually get you? To put it into context, in order to just go and buy 3,000 tokens, and that is the maximum amount of tokens you can buy in a single purchase, costs £100 for 3,000. £100 for 3,000. And with buying one of these packs while they were erroneously on sale, you were getting the equivalent. I worked it out. You were getting the equivalent of about £2,500 worth of in-game currency. If you were to buy, and there was no limit on the number of these packs that you could buy, and I just kept buying them, thinking, is it going to stop? Like, is this for real? And I ended up buying about 500,000 in-game tokens.
How much did you spend?
I spent about £30.
Oh wow!
About thirty real pounds, and I was sort of expecting that at some point that it had an error or the game had crashed, and I'd loaned back up, and it was like, oh, this was a mistake. You know, here's your money back, but we've taken the tokens back. So I also started to quickly spend them. But the thing is if you normally buy a pack of cards in the game for about $4.99. You might at most get 750 tokens, because that buys you 10 of the premium in-game card packs. So that's normally, for £5, you might get a premium selection of 10 cards. And I'd got 500,000 tokens by spending £30. And I worked out this number as well, and that worked out at about £16,000. Just over £16,000 worth of in-game currency is what I managed to get for £30. So this is obviously a mistake, and for about 10 minutes you could buy this, but eventually it went off sale and you couldn't buy anymore. But it still meant that I was able to buy hundreds of packs of cards, which is, like, as I said, this is the asphalt equivalent to a loot box. And having spent about a third of them so far, that equates to about £5,000 worth of in-game currency that I've actually spent already. I have unlocked and specced up some of the best and fastest and most competitive cars that you can get in the game, but not all. And many, many, many more of them are still locked. And even the ones that were giving me the blueprints as I was just spending and spending and spending my way through this currency, I was still not getting all the cars. I was getting tons and tons and tons of duplicates. So it, to me, and this is the bottom line, this error allowed me to really see for myself just how much money you could realistically be required to spend in order to unlock everything in the game. But the satisfaction when you get some of these cards popping up is really, really addictive and very, very satisfying. And so it really made me feel like, well, this is how you see these reports of people spending thousands of dollars and thousands of pounds in these games, because the games will take that money and you still won't get everything you want. And I've got £16,000 worth of credits in total to spend, and I've still not unlocked everything. It was really illuminating.
So this is your hobby now, is unlocking things, because you've now got so many credits you can't ever reasonably get through them.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
I mean, 500,000 is quite a lot, isn't it? So,
yeah, I mean, I've never had more than about maybe 2,000 at one go. You might just playing the game and not buying anything, you might earn in a week maybe 500, maybe more. But
crikey,
about that, and I've got, well, I had about 500,000. I've got left now, I think, about just under 300,000.
Did you get anything you were really hoping for out of this?
Yeah, loads. You know, plenty of it.
But has it ruined the game, you know, now, because you've got so much stuff?
It does, and I didn't want to go into too much depth on this in this particular story, but on the extended version of this podcast, that's what we're going to talk about a little later on in the show, is actually sort of the ethics of this and the impact it has on things like multiplayer and competitiveness, and whether that's basically a form of cheating, whether it's unfair, whether I should stop playing, as well as that. So we are going to come back to that in a little bit, but I just thought, in the context of the House of Lords proposal, what we've seen in other countries, like, this allowed me to see firsthand just how much money you can pump into these games. And Asphalt 9 is by no means unique in this regard. I mean, I'm only picking on it because I play it and this error happened this week. But realistically, this could be in any game, and you could spend that money if you wanted to. The shop's still open. So I think it is an important topic that we address, because, that's kind of ridiculous.
And I think that I certainly see this from my own experience. And kids obviously want to buy in-game things. Like, my kids play Roblox, and want to buy Robux. And I'm very firmly, no. Not because it's particularly, I don't think it's like that. I think what you're doing is you're essentially able to pay for certain things. It's not a loot box game, I don't believe. But I just, I just don't want to. It never ends once you start that. And I know that their cousins have access to these things as well. I'm on a losing battle here. But for as long as I can, I'm gonna resist the in-game currency thing for kids.
Ars Technica was one of a number of outlets this week that wrote about the Unreal Engine developer, Epic Games, probably heard of them, which released an app called Live Link Face, and it's an iPhone app that uses the front-facing 3D sensors in the phone to do live motion capture for facial animations in 3D projects, like video games, obviously, or films. Ars said that the app uses tools, official tools, that Apple makes available using its ARKit framework, as well as its TrueDepth sensor, which is what's used for Face ID, for unlocking your phone and things, to stream live motion capture from an actor, but presumably from anything that's being detected as a face, looking at the phone and mapping that to 3D characters in the Unreal Engine, which would be presumably working on a workstation nearby. But there's I'm quoting Ars here. It says there's a clear selling point, for a narrow audience at least, which is that indie developers and filmmakers can use apps like this on the iPhone for motion capture and essentially bring virtual characters to life that is usually in the confines of a well-equipped studio with lots of money, and therefore not minor players or the sort of one person and their dog development studios. And the motion capture of the iPhone sensors isn't going to be as accurate as for the big Hollywood studios, but it's at least now available to smaller teams, and it was cost prohibitive before. Now, that all seemed to me like a fairly positive, optimistic set of statements and an exciting development for people like us who just like seeing cool stuff happen on things that we already own. But we have an extended friend of the show, Marta Svetek, who is a motion capture artist, extremely familiar with the technology required of a motion capture studio because it's her job. And she's been on the show before talking about motion capture on a couple of occasions. So I thought, rather than Ian and I talking around this for hours on end and getting half the stuff wrong, I just called her up and asked if she would talk to us about what she thought of this. Interesting side note, because Marta is such an interesting person, the first time I spoke to her, she was on the back of a horse, and then she called me back when she was on a train. So that's two modes of transport. But we finally settled on the third and final choice, which is while she was sitting getting her hair done in a salon. And so that is where the following interview took place earlier on today. And I asked her if Ars's description of the technology was justifiable or justified in its optimism. And this is what Marta had to say.
It is an optimistic view. What you have to keep in mind always with these apps is that the underlying technology was not meant for motion capture. It was not made for motion capture. It captures the bare minimum of the facial movement that is required for its original function. That means that the capture that you're going to do, that you're going to get, the data that you're going to get from the capture with this technology is going to be fairly rudimentary. Now, facial capture is very difficult. Even with the most expensive head-mounted cameras, like from Faceware and from some other great makers of these setups, it is very difficult. It requires a lot of detail that needs to be captured from our facial expressions. Now, we are very sensitive to the language of our faces, of looking at each other's faces. We pick up on the smallest inconsistencies, and we have such micro movements that still communicate things to us. So an app like this is never going to be fully true in its capture. That said, a lot of people in the indie film and indie video game development areas, they don't need that level of detailed capture because their character models are also much simpler. So cartoony character models that are not necessarily photorealistic humans or humans at all, but need to convey human facial emotions, the face types. It can be very effective for that. And at the end of the day, the reason you do motion capture and not hand animation, the main reason is to save time on animation, because technically you can hand animate everything, but motion capture records that animation for you, so you don't need to, you know, by hand animate every single little moving part. And if this technology can save these developers the time they would spend on animating their characters' faces, then that's awesome. The other reason why it would be exciting that Epic or Unreal did an app themselves is for previs. Now, what you in an ideal world want to do as fast as possible is pre-visualize the movement of the character on the character rig in the environment it's going to be in. Now, Unreal Engine is perfect for that. That's what it's been used for years. So if their app can make it easy to stream your motion capture live into the engine and you get to see a really good mock-up of your end result, then that is worth a lot to the individual creator and is bringing a Hollywood level of sort of a production pipeline to the individual. That said, it still will not be anywhere near as detailed as what the big setups can do. So, you know, it's optimistic to say now Hollywood-style production can be brought to the individual, but it's definitely a big step towards it. And I want to say at this point as well that this is not a new concept. Using iPhones for facial capture has been happening since the iPhone came out. It was just a little bit more bootstrapped. There is a very important distinction between how we capture faces versus how we capture bodies. Faces, to this day, are incredibly difficult to capture because of all the tiny little points that we need to capture, whereas bodies are much easier. And so for facial capture, you're still going to have to do cleanup, like a lot of cleanup on the data, even if you have the best rig in the world. But if this can get you there faster, that is already, you know, saving you time and money. So it'll be good for previs. It'll be good for facial capture for certain types of characters, regardless of how big, you know, your studio is. If your character rig does not require that level of detail on the face, why go the complicated route?
So there's Marta Svetek talking about her opinion on this as a motion capture artist, a professional motion capture artist. We'll include a link to her Instagram in the show notes at uktechshow.com and in the MP3 description for the podcast. Off memory, I believe she is at Martholio. Was MARTHOLIO on Instagram, and she posts a lot of videos of behind the scenes of her mocap work, and I would strongly recommend anyone interested in that to have a look at that and give her a follow. She is a fountain of knowledge and a very competent axe thrower, not even joking.
Yes. I was hoping to find out firsthand about the axe throwing ability of Marta, but unfortunately the coronavirus put paid to that and we're having to wait until this is all over.
Now, we used to do this at the beginning of the show, but now we've moved past our first story. I just wanted to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters. If you're one of them, this is, of course, your extended ad-free version of the show that you're enjoying. And we'll be coming back to the loot box topic in a little bit, as we mentioned. But I wanted to, in particular this week, thank patrons including Mark Hall, Ian Baxter and CJ, who all joined us as patrons since our last episode and are joining the wonderful listeners who are supporting us directly. So if you're enjoying the free version of the show and might want to consider becoming a patron and supporting us directly, you'll get our ad-free full-length show, our Patreon-exclusive weekly sister show, Extra Message. A lot of people get that, as well as access to our private Discord community that many people actually have been saying is one of their favorite aspects of being a patron. But either way, if you wish to do that, you can go to patreon.com/UKTech and learn more. And there's no commitment. Well, obviously, as come as no surprise to anyone at this part of the show, we remind you that Text Message keeps you informed about the British tech landscape. But let's check in with our good friend Tom Merritt at Daily Tech News Show and hear what's been happening in the wider world of tech over the last week.
It was Security Week on DTNS this week. Stephanie Ihezukwu helped us avoid getting socially engineered. Kirsten Brazier talked to us about the real dangers of industrial security. Seth Rosenblatt from the Parallax gave us tips to keep our work and personal data separate and secure. Mike Johnson and Alan Alford of the CISO Series podcast helped us understand how to keep our businesses secure. And Alyssa Miller told us what we do and do not need to worry about with deepfakes. All that and a lot more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Well, that is a breathless Tom Merritt, if I've ever heard one, cramming all of that into a 30-second promo.
He did good.
He did good. And I thought the Security Week was very, very timely and interesting, and I would highlight the deepfakes episode as well, because one of the topics that came up during that discussion was around the growing risk of real-time deepfakes, which is where you could essentially, I mean, they gave an example of quote-unquote Elon Musk showing up in somebody's Zoom call and actually convincing somebody that Elon Musk was crashing their stream. And so we always talk about, well, have traditionally talked about deepfakes as these kind of post-produced things that have been deliberately manipulated in order to be uploaded somewhere, whether that's for revenge porn reasons or for political reasons or whatever. But I hadn't really thought about it in the context of real-time participation in events in some form where you could actually have a two-way exchange with a quote-unquote person. So anyway, that's all out, dailytechnewsshow.com. I do definitely recommend that particular episode, but the whole week was very, very good. Ian, I feel like our whole week has been very, very good, but it's been taken to a new height by spending an hour or so in your company today. So thank you for that.
Well, it's been wonderful, hasn't it? Always lovely, even though the rooms that we sit in to do this get hotter and hotter as the podcast goes on. And I don't know about you, but I'm now quite warm.
Yes, I'm quite warm. Yeah. Well, if we were together in person, then we could strip off our clothes and go into the other room and have a bit of a struggle. But I have to go and edit a podcast now. So thank you, listeners. Thank you, patrons. Thank you, everyone, for listening live. And we'll see you in 1 week for another sweaty instance of Text Message.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.